Hey! Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. I'm your host, Cedric Youngelman. In this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, I chat with Preston Pish, an investor, author, host of Bitcoin Fundamentals, co-founder of the Investors Podcast Network, and much more. Preston's passion lies in making complex ideas simple, and he brings that clarity here as we explore the unraveling of the petrodollar system and the seismic shift toward a Bitcoin-centric financial future. If you're looking to deepen your understanding of how Bitcoin intersects with geopolitics, macroeconomics, and the future of money, this rip is for you. If you want to get in touch with me, it's Cedric at thebitcoinmatrix.com. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Preston Pish.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Preston Pish is an entrepreneur, investor, author, co-founder, host of Bitcoin Fundamentals, and a Bitcoin proponent. He's the founder of BuffettsBooks.com, and his videos on financial investing have been viewed by millions of people around the world. He takes great pleasure in taking complex ideas and making them accessible. Preston graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point with a Bachelor of Science in Aerospace Engineering, and from Johns Hopkins with an MBA in Banking and Finance. He has authored and co-authored a number of investment and autobiographical works. Preston also wrote multiple finance and investing-related articles for Forbes from 2016 and 2018. When he's not having some of the most fascinating conversations on earth, he enjoys spending time with his wonderful family. Preston Pish, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Hey, how you doing, sir? Thank you for that.
It's great to see you. How you been?
Good. Yeah, just enjoying enjoying these markets, enjoying spring.
I saw you. I think I saw you tweet from England for Cheat Code.
Yeah. Boy, that was fun.
I'd love to hear about that. And I saw you at Sailor's party on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And I think I saw you in South Carolina maybe a year ago.
I'm all over, man.
And I'm sure you do a lot more traveling beyond that. So yeah, you are all over. How do you like the traveling?
It's good. I mean, if it's in a decent location, like, I don't mind it at all. I don't think my wife minds me, you know, getting out of the house from time to time too, because I think I drive her crazy. So, you know, it's a win-win.
Fair enough. What about as a macro, you know, economic finance guy, value investor?
Yeah.
I mean, you're probably looking at a lot of data on the screen and everything, but like, how much do your travels play into how you're interpreting the economy or signals?
A little bit. I mean, I'm having conversations with locals and whatnot just to kind of pick their brain as to what's different. But for the most part, I think the whole world is really coming to grips with inflation really being a big deal these days. You know, it doesn't really matter if you're in the U.S. or you're over in Europe or Australia or wherever. Everybody's kind of dealing with it. And the stories that I've heard, especially over in Europe, it seems to be kind of picking up even more for a lot of folks. It's just getting more challenging. So a lot of the conversations all revolve around that, to be quite honest with you.
What do you think is going on with inflation? The administration seems to say it's like leveling off, maybe with like prices of eggs and things. What do you think is happening here with inflation?
Well, I would say that is a very short-term political talking point that, you know, might be true within a two-month window or a four-month window. But beyond that, and it might continue for a couple more months or half a year or something like that. But the broader trend is what I, you know, would typically talk about, and the underpinnings and the forces that are causing that to change from what we had been accustomed to for so many years, at least here in the United States. And, you have a massive global deleveraging event. We talk about Ray Dalio and his thesis all the time on these types of shows. But what's really happening is, the petrodollar system is ending. And because of that, you have a unraveling of, here in the U.S., you used to used to push all these dollars out, and you were effectively exporting inflation through global cooperation. And now all that's starting to unwind because nobody trusts the dollar and the underpinnings of those monetary units anymore. And because of that, all of that exported inflation is going to start manifesting itself and start coming back for all global advanced G7 nation states are going to start experiencing that. And you might have like, it's going to ebb and flow, right? Like, so prices are down in the last 2 or 3 months, but then again, they're just going to continue to rip even harder moving forward. So I think that COVID, you know, 2020 was probably the very top of this petrodollar system, as good as it gets, global cooperation system that persisted for about 40 years. Now you're starting to have all of that unravel and spin the other way. And, you know, it's going to take some time. It's going to probably take another decade, two decades to really fully materialize into what comes next, which is, you know, in my opinion, a Bitcoin being at the center of global finance and global commerce. You know, it might get there faster. I don't know, but it's going to take some time. It's going to take some time for that to play out.
Yeah, definitely. What do you think then? I mean, you mentioned the end of the petrodollar. Do you think we're moving to something like a Bitcoin dollar? How do you see stable coins sort of like being part of maybe the economy over the next few years?
So this whole Bitcoin dollar, you know, there's some pieces that have been written on this and they throw around that terminology and whatnot. That I would just say it's a Bitcoin system. The whole world is moving to a monetary unit that's based on Bitcoin being at the root of it all. You're going to see dollars that are going to be attempted to be backed by things. You know, I've been talking a lot about Bitcoin-backed bonds and some of these other things. You got the strategic reserve where, you know, governments are trying to hold Bitcoin as a store of value against all of their printing. But at the end of the day, it's Bitcoin is the new unit of account. And like you just had Jack Maulers go on TV and they announced this 21 conglomerate, you know, he's going to be the CEO. And he's saying, my whole premise is to get additional Bitcoin per share for anybody that's a shareholder. And so there's a perfect example of somebody who gets it, somebody who knows what the new unit of account is and what everything on the planet should be measured against, which is how much Bitcoin is there per share. It could be per ounce. It could be per pound. It could be for, you know, whatever, but it's always going to be in reference to how much Bitcoin is associated with whatever that unit is. So, you know, I think there's some terminology at play when people say Bitcoin backed dollars and things like that.
But what about stable coins? Do you see them playing a very large role in the economy, maybe like, you know, being a place for US treasuries to be bought?
So at the end of the day, the stable coins are going to, I think, be an enormous part of the economy moving forward. You're going to have banks. They're getting ready to roll out legislation in the U.S. that fully enables Wall Street banks to start tokenizing sovereign debt and issuing their own stable coins similar to Circle or Tether. And so once you start getting more participants in that particular space and that particular game, it's just going to continue to take off, right? And at the end of the day, the government and the government in the U.S., the government in Europe, they need some type of buyer, some natural free and open market buyer of all this sovereign issuance. Because if it's not, it's just going to be the government itself that's buying it back. And then you don't have a free market and you don't have free interest rates and you don't have free rates of cost of capital, which means you effectively have price controls on everything. And you might still have that. It doesn't mean that you're not going to have some semblance of that. But the stable coins, I do think, interject a form of a free and open market for the cost of capital. It assists in some kind of way for people that are actually demanding dollars to hold, call it in third world countries or anywhere else in the world that just have access issues to the dollar. So I think it's going to really take off from here. It's going to be interesting to see what rails they do it on. To date, it's been Ethereum, Tron, Solana that have pretty much been the main ones that all these stable coins have been issued on. I would make the argument that that's pretty much the only utility and the only use case that has actually come out of those networks. And so it's going to be interesting to see now that you have Taproot Asset Protocol and you had Tether just make the announcement like a month and a half, 2 months ago, that they're going to start issuing Tether stablecoins on top of the Lightning Network using the Taproot Asset Protocol. I think that's a really interesting development because that's giving competition to these other ones that have higher fees, that are slower, that are more centralized, less security. So game on, right? And I guess you could maybe say that those are dollar-backed, you know, Bitcoin, whatever. It's riding on top of the layer two Bitcoin network, right? But they're not tethered to Bitcoin itself.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we can maybe dig into the Bitcoin dollar thing later, but I want to ask you about, I mean, you brought up COVID, so I want to bring up gold. I mean, gold, I think I just saw has outperformed the S&P 500 since COVID now. I want your know your thoughts maybe on gold and, you know, what maybe is gold seeing or being revisited? Is its role being revisited in the world as maybe an interplay or transitional phase back before we see a much more Bitcoin system?
Yeah, I mean, you have people who don't understand Bitcoin, first and foremost. Most don't understand it. I think anybody who's, you know, has a pulse understands gold. They know that gold's been around for millennia and that it's, you know, performed as a store of value, especially in terms of in, currency crisis and sovereign debt crises. So, you know, I think people see that and they have concerns around all the printing that's happening. They're looking at the budget deficit issues. They're looking at how hard it is to get any of that under control. And so they're just like, oh, I can go to Costco and buy some gold. So I will. And it's really kind of that simple. They just get it. They understand it. Yep. As far as its performance relative to Bitcoin, you know, I mean, I think Bitcoin's going to continue to wreck its world with respect to buying power. In fact, it might even amplify what it's already done compared to gold, and it definitely will do it compared to some other things. But, you know, is it something that will preserve buying power for people? Yeah, I suspect it will. I mean, it's done better, like you said, it's done better than the S&P 500 since COVID. I have this really interesting post, I think it was in 2020 or 2021, where I made this call. I said, I think that at this point moving forward after COVID, that Bitcoin is going to be the number one thing to own. I think gold is going to be the next thing to own, and then equities, and then I just go down the list. And I had this chart that I keep posting updates to about every 6 months that lays this out. And so far, gold has underperformed the stock indices. So I'm excited to hear that it's finally back on top, because now it makes that projection somewhat true, at least for the moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, gold is, it's something interesting. I got it from Trace Mayer.
Yeah.
Where you kind of describe this cultural notion of you want to like accumulate gold and you want to see your gold get bigger. And you kind of have even had this physical relationship with it, where you talked about maybe it was a certain culture where they pet the gold and just kind of like feel the gold growing. And I remember walking into a Costco, and I don't go there too often, but about a year ago or maybe 8 months ago. And I was like, you got any of those gold chips or whatever you got? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, really? And I know they were like moving fast. I bought one. I keep the receipt with me. Mm-hmm. And I just really wanted sort of like a physical representation of gold in my life to kind of get a little closer to it, I think. I think there's a lot to learn from gold. And I think Bitcoin and gold bugs should have more, you know, see their commonalities.
I definitely see the commonalities, but I also see the differences, which is you can't see that gold bar through this screen like you can with Bitcoin right now.
Right.
And that's a big difference. When we're thinking about the speed and the frequency of commerce, I think that's something that's lost on a lot of people that are like non-engineers and don't understand frequencies and the pace that things need to keep up with, especially with AI and everything else that's happening around the world. You know, to settle something in a hard currency 100 years ago based on the frequency of trade and the pace that things moved, you know, you could get away with it. I mean, I guess you could say you couldn't, because that's why paper currency existed. And that's why it was stood up on top of gold. And that's why it continued to fail from a sovereign level for all these, you know, since millennia. But we don't have those problems anymore. And whether people want to recognize that or not, well, that's on them to figure out. But the people who actually conduct the proof of work to understand the why it's different are going to find that they're rewarded, I think, substantially.
Yeah. At my desk, I also keep this large piece of fake gold. It was my first lesson with gold. I was about 6 or 7 when my older brother, who's 9 years older than me, gave me this large piece of what he told me was real gold. I brought it to school. I told the whole class, and that show and tell is my real gold, and they told me I was wrong. And I said, my brother would never lie to me. You're wrong, you know. And then I came home. My brother told me the truth. And I've kept that my whole life. It's just, I mean, to even feel the difference of how heavy it is and how real it feels, and it's completely fake, was sort of a lesson in of itself.
And so here's the correlation to Bitcoin.
Hey, Bitcoiners, I'm heading to Bitcoin 2025 in Las Vegas from May 27th to May 29th, and you need to be there. This isn't just another conference. It's the ultimate Bitcoin party. Grab your ticket now using promo code MATRIX or at the link in the description. See you in Vegas, freaks. Let's make this one legendary.
That difference is the difference between somebody running a node and somebody who's trusting somebody else to run the node for them, right? The person who's trusting somebody to run the node to verify whether they actually got sent real Bitcoin or not is the person who might accept the fake gold. So run your own node. When you accept payment, you know, accept that payment through and verify the payment through that node's, you know, ledger. And that's how Bitcoin does it. You know, people would look at Bitcoin and be like, how can you audit? Well, that's how you audit it. That's how you know instantly that it was real, that was one of those 21 million units that was sent to you.
Well, there you go. You brought up that word audit. Do we have the gold? Aren't we supposed to get results of an audit?
I have no idea, but I do find it interesting that they're talking about it as if they can't find out instantly or have somebody there, you know, go out there and conduct the audit immediately if the president would ask for it. So the real question is this posturing for something else? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was sitting there, I know what I'd be doing, but, you know, I don't know what they're doing.
It wouldn't be hard to send someone over from the big four accounting firms to do a brief review to ascertain in material effect if there's just even a large quantity of rocks there.
But if I wanted to create a bit of a scare and a bit of a price run to then reprice the gold that I have on the books at the Treasury to basically use it as an excuse to print a bunch of money and then go buy Bitcoin with it, that's exactly what I would do.
Mm. Interesting. I thought it was interesting. I think the crypto czar said something about there's going to be a Bitcoin audit.
Right. So that was supposed to happen as well. And it's weeks. I think we're weeks later now. I think it was supposed to be done 2 weeks ago and we still haven't heard anything. And you would think that would be something really easy to just say, hey, yeah, what we thought we had is all there. But they haven't.
Do you think it could be about anything else besides what the large stockpile that they're referring to? Could they think they're going to... Because they said something about, we're going to search every department.
Yeah, I know.
You know.
But they haven't reported anything.
Sure.
Again, if you want to get really fancy with things, you can sell spot, hold the price down so you can step into a derivatives market and buy something, you know, with 1 to 2 years of duration and have a significant impact.
Right.
That was weird. I've never had that happen in an interview. My phone just started playing music. I don't know if Siri heard me say something or what.
Something triggered.
Wild. Yes, it was.
Yeah. We don't know what kind of games are being played behind the scenes and what real intentions are. So that kind of brings me to like tariffs. I mean, what is your take on what's happened so far with the rollout of tariffs and the revisiting of this topic?
So tariffs are a function of the fundamental shift in the petrodollar system, like I talked about earlier. So when you are constantly exporting, when you're the global currency reserve of the world, right, the dollar, one of the consequences of this is that you have to run trade deficits. That comes inherently with it. So if you would rewind the tape, and let's say Europe was the one that was exporting euros all over the world, like the euro started back instead of the dollar and all that. they would be the ones with the massive trade deficits, and they would be the ones in the same exact scenario that we are today, where they've exported all their manufacturing because of currency arbitrage, all of that work and all of the physical, tangible things that have to be performed, especially from a commodity standpoint, get pushed outside of our country, and it's incentivized for it to get pushed out of our country because of the currency arbitrage. So now once that gets so extreme and that pendulum swings so far to one side, now you're at a situation where nobody in this country can do anything without the raw inputs to the things that they want to consume, right? Especially complex end items. You get into like a car or an aircraft or anything that's like really complex from an engineering standpoint that has all these different pieces and parts to it. All those pieces and parts are built everywhere but here. Then they're shipped here, and then they might be assembled here. But there, you probably have a midpoint end item that is then put into the complex end item, okay? The final sell-off. That all of these things are being assembled outside of the country and shipped here, and maybe the final touches is happening inside the U.S. And so why this is a major issue, especially think of it from a DOD standpoint, a Department of Defense standpoint, okay? If you're reliant... And Luke Roman had an amazing post today. He says, you know, people will say that the dollar is backed by the Department of Defense and our military might. But what backs that? Like, let's go down the rabbit hole a little bit further, right? What backs that? Well, the raw precious metals, oftentimes coming from China, are what back that. Right. If you got an F-22 or you got some type of complex war machine that requires very special precious metals in order to keep them flying and keep them going, and those pieces and parts are coming from a country that, you know, doesn't like you or that you're trying to play hardball with. Well, congratulations. You just found out that what you thought was your Trump card is in fact just, you know, you lying to yourself. And I think that when we look at what our number one export has been, which is the dollar in the United States, that's just paper. That is just a paper promise. And people have completely lost sight of that. They think that it's military strength, and or they think that that's might or that's strength. But in reality, when you start pulling back and the math doesn't work anymore, and so then you have to go to the next thing that was totally backing that, which was military might and force and strength through technology, through advanced technology. Well, what's backing the advanced technology? You just got to keep pulling it back. And what you find is what you think is your negotiation leverage is actually your weakness. And I think some people are getting this very confused right now. Now, do I understand why they're doing it? Of course I understand why they're doing it. In fact, if I'm sitting in the hot seat, I'm trying to do the same thing. And so what the question really comes down to is the method that's being used. Is it the right method or not to try to bring onshoring back in a way that doesn't disrupt into world chaos? And we can talk about that all day long. And the fact of the matter is you don't know the counter. Like, so let's talk that. What might work for one person, let's say Trump goes there with his strategy on tariffs, and let's say he gets his way because the Chinese had too much pain and they fold, right? Well, then you could make the argument that his approach was amazing. It was really good. But let's say the Chinese like lean into it and they're saying, you don't have the cards, we have the cards. And they cause total chaos. And he's caught in a situation where he was way too far over his ski tips with, you know, the trade policies and all these tariffs. Well, then you can make the argument that the approach was really bad. But what's interesting is in this scenario, what we're really looking at is human psychology and people actually understanding the cards that they hold, their pain tolerance. Like, there's a lot that goes into this, right? So I'm not going to sit here and say that what he's doing is good or bad. I'm just going to kind of lay out like it's a pretty complex thing that's taking place. It's very difficult. I think we can all agree that more of the same of where this was all trending, to keep doing those types of policies and further trade deficits and further exporting through currency arbitrage of, you know, we can't even do literally nothing because it's all been incentivized to be offshore, is even worse. So, you know, those are some of my thoughts. And it might sound like it's a pretty apolitical take, and I guess it is a little bit of an apolitical take, but I also think that there's a lot of nuance to this that's lost on people that aren't really fully grasping all the critical variables of it.
Do you think that, like, we're in some broader currency war with China and we could head to sort of something kinetic, and all this is sort of hopefully negotiating our way away from that slash on our path towards that if it fails?
If Bitcoin didn't exist, I think the probability of something kinetic would be extremely high, because you have to come to terms on what's the new unit of account that everybody can agree is the unit of account. And if that is gold, which it most likely would be if we weren't in a Bitcoin world, then you have to come to agreements on how you're going to settle that. And you already don't like each other and you already don't trust each other, and it's too freaking slow to actually settle. So I think the chances of something happening kinetically would have been way higher if Bitcoin didn't exist. The fact that Bitcoin does exist, and the fact that so many countries can clearly audit the code and the math, they can trust it. And they don't need to go over there and sit down with the NSA or whoever code breaker that they've got to trust it. They can just look at the math and they can verify that nobody can screw me in this. And therefore, yeah, I'll send you this oil or I'll send you this precious metal. Just send me some Bitcoin. And if they settle it that way, I think there's a chance that we can actually all get along without there being some type of kinetic fight. What are the probabilities? I don't know, but I can tell you this, they're a whole lot higher than if we were going to go back onto some gold standard with paper writing on top of it. I can assure you that.
Yeah. I mean, I would think if there's going to be some sort of like Bretton Woods 2.0, I mean, the only reason I could think that a major country hasn't come out and sort of game theoretically, like started announcing Bitcoin buying now or already an established position is because maybe they have to roll out a multilateral agreement before that's announced. And kind of all come to terms the way they did coming out of Bretton Woods. What, you know, they all knew how much gold they had, or they could all say, we have this. But at some point, it's like, it's all going to be in North America, and we're going to have a tethered relationship. And I think we might be in a similar situation with Bitcoin.
All of that happened after we beat the living hell out of each other.
Right.
Right? And you realized real fast who was the big dog. Who was the person that you didn't want to screw with anymore because they just literally killed so many of your young men, right? That's that discussion and that agreement happened after all of that. But what I think is playing out this time around is the peaceful version of all of that, or at least that's what I'm praying for, right? Is that we have an opportunity because of just how physics and math and everybody with an internet connection can look and see that they can actually trust this thing because they know no one individual controls anything. It's a collective good that's just been blessed into existence through, you know, engineers that have worked their tails off and really, really sound incentives that allow everybody to agree on a protocol. And because of that, I think we have the capacity to potentially sidestep the kinetic part of this. I really do. I pray we do. I mean, I've been to combat. I spent 2 years of my life in combat. Let me tell you, nobody wants to deal with that. Nobody wants to experience that ever. So we should be doing everything we can to try to usher this in. And how do you usher it in? You usher it in with what you're doing right now, Cedric. It's education. It's knowledge. It's like a light that's illuminating everybody in the world so that they can see that you don't have to experience pain. Like I can go over there to my son and say, hey, that oven's hot. I can give you all the reasons why. I can educate him all day long, and he has to either listen or he wants to. He can learn two ways. He can learn through somebody else's experience, or he can learn through pain. And it's like he can make that choice. And I just, you know, I pray that enough people in this world are going to go out and try to learn through other people's experience and knowledge as opposed to pain. But they're going to learn one way or the other.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about maybe nationalism and patriotism right now, even in our country, and like maybe what your feelings are? Like, do you feel very nationalistic or patriotic?
You know, I, as a person who served in the military, you would think I'd be a raging patriot, right? And I'm not saying that I'm not, but I look at humanity. I've traveled around the world enough that I've gone to places and I have friends. You know, I went to grad school with people from China. I have friends from all sorts of countries. And what everybody will always tell you is the people, the citizens inside of all these countries are good people on a net basis, right? They're good. I have no beef with it, and neither does anybody else for the most part. The people who are seeking power are the ones that feel like they have to submit the rest of the world to this dominance or this behavior. And I'm telling you, we don't have to act this way. And unfortunately, patriotism sometimes fuels these urges that I am good, you are bad, and it puts it into binary. And what I would really challenge people to do is step beyond that. Take it from me, a person who literally lived violence for 2 years of my life, man. There is a better way. There is a better way to get along. And so I would just caution people to not be just blindly patriotic, right? I have no remorse speaking out about what our government's doing right and what it's doing wrong. Because you got to be objective, right? Everybody needs to look at things objectively and with intelligence and with knowledge. So I would just caution some of the patriotic urges that people have.
Sure.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Do you see a future, though, where we onshore maybe manufacturing, even if it doesn't maybe bring sort of mass labor back, but maybe it's AI and robots and we're producing things here again? And maybe, kind of getting back to the rare earth minerals, maybe they're not as rare. Maybe at these prices, only China's willing to, maybe we have more rare earth minerals here than we know about, or, you know, maybe we'll compete in different ways. What do you see?
So the thing is the tariffs are going to incentivize onshoring. The problem that comes along with it is it's going to cause prices to increase quite substantially, which then doesn't become politically popular, which then changes the political dynamic as to like what the country wants. So although I understand the intention, where I'm concerned is the execution and the viability of the execution because of the way that the political system works. And you have, I mean, it is the most short term. I mean, we got midterms coming up in, you know, a year. A lot of that's going to start kicking off for the midterms, right? A year and a couple months. And so if the prices start taking hold and if these tariffs, do you think that they're going to win the midterms if that's looking bad? And so then do you think that they can do any of these policies if they lose Congress? No. Right. So the challenge is more in how you would execute this to actually get it to take hold through some of these policies that, you know, I understand the logic. It's the execution that's the hard part.
Ray Dalio, I think you retweeted, said something around, he's like worried about something worse than a recession. Yeah. Do you have sort of major liquidity problem sort of in your view in the near term? Do you think we can face something worse than a recession?
So one thing that COVID really demonstrated to me as a person who's studied financial markets quite a bit is you were in this environment where the entire globe was shut down. Everybody was sitting in their house, not working, not doing anything. And you would have thought that markets would have just tanked of epic proportions. They would have been down for a year plus because there would have been so much loss in GDP, and the knock-on effect would have been terrible. But that's not what happened. What happened was is the markets went down for, I don't know, 20 days, 30 days. And then within another 30 days, they were already making new all-time highs. Okay. And this is in the depths of people sitting at home. So what I learned through that scenario that couldn't have been demonstrated any clearer is when they print a bunch of money and they shove it into the market, these markets can do anything, absolutely anything. And so as I'm sitting here and people are like, well, what's going to happen in the next 6 months or into the end of the year? Like, I suspect they're probably going to keep the markets liquid, that they're not going to let contagion set in too much. They're not going to have too much impairment in the credit markets. But it really does come down to the couple people sitting in the room at the Fed and at, you know, the ECB and the others as to how many fiat monetary units they're going to add into the system. Okay. Because at the end of the day, if we're comparing Bitcoin to the performance of the dollar or any of these fiats, you have to talk about the dominant player as to how many fiat units are in the system. So I think that they're going to print. It's just a matter of like at what magnitude and at what pace that really determines the answer to that question. And again, it's not me sidestepping the question. It's me just having a deep appreciation for how much they actually control the price of everything through their printing.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your reaction to the specific day a few weeks ago where we saw massive volatility in the traditional markets and even in Bitcoin. Bitcoin kind of held up really well during that comparatively. I'm not trying to make anything sort of a declarative statement about Bitcoin versus the other things, but what did you think of that volatility and sort of America's reaction to it? And it seemed different than COVID. It seemed a little bit more purposely self-inflicted, whether that was 4D chess or not, but like they kind of released some news that they knew would drive or seem like, yeah, the market will crash after that news.
Yeah.
What'd you think of the reaction to it and everything?
Yeah. At the end of the day, the way the Wall Street works and the pricing of especially all equity and fixed income is the market is constantly looking at what they think the future's what future array is going to be the most probable. And what happened was, is you had a lot of people that were making these models and they're saying, I don't think tariffs are going to be nearly as big of a deal as what Trump and his administration were talking about. And then surprise, he rolls out and he's standing there with this big old chart that says, we are literally going to tariff everybody and at all these levels. And it was kind of like the whole market. Anybody that had any type of financial projection was like, oh my God, I'm dead wrong. Like, this is crazy, right? And this is rolling out in days, right? So if you're doing a model and you're projecting that expenses are going to be this, and this is how they're going to collect it from a tax revenue standpoint, and now it's just all shifted over to this, that's a lot of risk that you have to then price into the market. And so that's what it was. It was a repricing of risk. And so think about not just the underlying price of, call it company XYZ, and it has $100 billion market cap. Just the futures that are on top of that one company alone are massive, massive. And now do it for every company on the planet, every fixed income instrument on the planet, and the derivatives market that we're talking about are quadrillions for this, okay, on top of all of this. And all that futures market is the quadrillions is just think of it almost like a reinforcement mechanism for the underlying. So if the underlying's coming down, all those derivatives on top of it are just pushing it that much faster. And so all of this got repriced, and that's what we were seeing. That was the volatility chop that you were seeing in the market. And then as soon as they, you know how they calmed it all down, they said, oh, well, we're not going to do it for all these other things. We're going to push that off and we're just going to do it with China. And then the whole market was like, oh, thank God, it wasn't as bad as we thought. And then you had liquidity come back into the market. So those are the moves. That's kind of the dynamic of like what's happening in the background. And the reason it's so volatile is you have to understand fiat. Fiat at its base is just a really small amount of units. And then it's all debt compiled on top of that, that spends and moves like it's the base money, even though it's not the base money. So when you're wrong and you were using that plethora of promises as if it was real money, that's what contracts so fast. And that's why you're seeing that tightening of liquidity happening, is because people had traded promises on top of promises as if it was real money, right? And the way to think about it, the most generic way to think about it, is if I go into a bar and let's say you're the bartender and I open a tab with you for a $5 beer, right? I didn't pay you for that, but we created a promise together. You said, you're going to pay me at the end of the night. I said, yeah. And what do I owe you? $5. Okay. So we just quote unquote created a promise. Now you could take that promise, walk out the back of the bar and say, hey, I want to buy this thing. This guy owes me $5. Here's my promise to you, but I'm good for it because this guy owes me $5. Right. So you can see how the promises start to compound on top of each other. And we're quote unquote creating what feels like real money. But at the end of the day, I have to somehow come up with a base, like a real dollar bill, to then hand you at the end of the night. I can't hand you another promise because you're saying, I don't take the promise anymore. I need the real thing because I have a bill that I've got to settle with somebody else. That's an asset on their books and a liability on mine. And same for me, that's a liability on my book, but an asset for you that you went out and traded. And this is how the whole thing works. Most of the entire system is built on these promises. And so when one promise blows up, so do the 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 more that were constructed on top of it. And so that's why you see this tightening effect that plays out.
Yeah. A couple of things I think about there. One, you know, I think a lot of people, or at least myself, I want to ask a silly question, like kind of understand like how stocks are kind of, you could kind of say maybe they're overvalued, or maybe they're, you know, kind of, we are in a more technological society, so maybe they're correctly valued, or and this one I like, or I don't like the, I like the Mag 7, or I don't, or I like FANG, or, and I think real estate people kind of understand, or kind of getting, you know, the leverage used there and how pricings work, and maybe how we won't go up forever, but we might go up a little bit this year or not. But I think what I get confused about is like when people say, like, what's going on with the bond market? Are they just referring to treasuries, or are they referring to sort of corporate bonds and junk bonds and municipal and all of it? So I guess that's the first question. Like when people like, and what is going on with bonds? Like how is bonds reacting, the bond market reacting to tariffs right now and everything going on in the economy?
So the bond market, the reason people like to talk about it is because it's so big. First and foremost, it's huge relative to stocks. So when you're thinking of it in terms of buying power, it represents a massive store of value for anybody with substantial amounts of net worth. When you also look at it, it's kind of the benchmark of your return profile. So if I can go out and get 5% in the bond market in 1 month money, right? I only lend it out for, you know, a month, and I'm getting a 5% annualized return for that. That kind of becomes my benchmark. So if I go out and buy a stock and the PE is 20, right? That's giving me a 5% return with a PE of 20. Meaning for every $20 I pay to own that company, I get $1 back in earnings every year. Okay. So that's where that 5% comes from. And so if I have a choice between getting a bond that I know the government can just print more of and give me the 5% back with no risk of not getting the 5% back, right? Now they're debasing it. That's a whole nother story, but I get that 5% back, right? So I give them $100 and I get my $5 back on an annualized basis versus this company that has to continue to do operations and all the risk around operations that might be lower, it might be higher, all that risk for the same 5%. Well, it's a no-brainer. I'm going to take the bond every day of the week, right? That's not even a hard decision. So that's how you think through the valuation process. That's why the bond market's such a big deal, is especially the sovereign bond market, because you know the government can just print it and they look at this as a risk-free rate. But I mean, those are like the basics of it from a valuation.
Sure.
Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. And then how big is, when you say the bond market is huge, I mean, how much of that is treasuries and short-term secured versus like corporate maybe debt?
Percentage wise, I'm not sure. I'd have to look. I'd have to AI that to kind of look up the percent. I should know that off the top of my head, but I don't.
I'm assuming the corporate bond market is a fraction of, or you know, but maybe that's just way off.
No,
I don't
think so. I would say it's almost at parity with each other, the sovereign and the corporate size. But I might be a little off. It might be like 60-40 if I was going to guess. And I'm probably going to hear about it on X that I'm way off or on money or whatever. But it's somewhere in that ballpark. But the important part is you're talking hundreds of trillions of dollars in size. It is massive. Yeah.
And maybe moving back to the new news with Jack Mahler's SoftBank, Cantor Fitzgerald. Have you had a moment to digest that and unpack that a little bit?
I haven't looked at it more than kind of the clips that I saw Jack on Bloomberg talking about what it was. Obviously teamed up with some massive players. I think they're starting off with, what was it, 42,000 Bitcoin in the treasury. I'm kind of curious how this works from like an operational standpoint, because like MicroStrategy makes a lot of sense to me, where you have a company that's operating, it produces a small relative to the size of the market cap of the company, produces a relatively small amount of profits year in and year out, and they're basically able to tap into capital markets to continue to grow because of how inefficiently priced capital markets are. And the desire, especially in the fixed income side, for access to Bitcoin. So they're willing to pay up at almost nothing coupon to do it. And now he's doing it in the preferred stock space. But I don't know how this is going to work for this company 21, where I don't really even know what their operating enterprise is. So that's the one question I have. I haven't dug into it. I mean, this was just announced, but that would be the one thing I'd want to learn more about before I would. And I guess is it through a SPAC? Do you know?
I think it is through a SPAC, but I think we're all hearing more and more about the details and the architecture of it. One thing I'm wondering with its relationship with Cantor Fitzgerald and Tether, I think, is also involved in this. Maybe.
Yeah, they are.
Do we see something because we've already seen, you know, the repeal of SAB 121. So now you have SAB 122. FASB rule changes are under our feet already, just depending on the rollout by the individual company. Do we ever see, and you mentioned they're Bitcoin-backed bonds, right? So I think that's really a way to maybe recapitalize, you know, state and local and even maybe the national government in certain ways. Could we see something like an FDIC-insured-backed Bitcoin loan?
FDIC-insured Bitcoin-backed loan. So walk me through the mechanics.
I don't know how to walk you through it yet. I just, back of the napkin, though, I mean, it's similar to a Bitcoin-backed bond, I would think, in just the sense that...
I mean, the only thing I can think is FDIC insurance is a disaster.
So you give them your Bitcoin, the entity, and they loan you fiat that's FDIC-insured... Meaning,
no, so like today, like if I put money on deposit at a bank,
right?
Like,
that's
they're gonna
under 250, right?
Yeah, they're gonna insure that deposit up to 250. Anything above the 250,000, if the bank goes bankrupt, like good luck,
right? So, if you deposit your Bitcoin and that's insured, FDIC insured up to 250K, and you get you can borrow off that or do anything you would do with cash at a bank, but it's FDIC insured
because banks actually don't have all the money that. You put on deposit there. That's why the government stood up the FDIC insurance, is to put trust into the banking institution up to a certain threshold, 250,000, right? That we know basically what the government is saying with FDIC is, we know this is a giant, this is not what they say, but this is effectively what they're saying indirectly. We know this is a giant scheme. We know this is a Ponzi scheme. Because all the money that's been put on deposit at this bank actually isn't here. But we will print the difference, or we will come up with 250,000 of it if the bank ever goes bankrupt. So you can trust the bank up to that amount. That's what FDIC insurance
right. does. So I'm now flip it.
Okay.
And you give the bank, you know, because they now can custody Bitcoin with SAB 122. You give the bank your Bitcoin.
Why would I do that?
Why? Because it's FDIC insured. So now if you get rugged,
okay,
the government's going to repair you.
But you have to believe that the government actually has all that.
Well, the FDIC insurance works the same way, where they don't have all the cash back the system either.
No. It doesn't work like that.
It
doesn't work like that. This is how it works.
Your mission: build the blockchain, stack sats, and resist surveillance. You'll need strategy, stealth, and a little luck. Welcome to Block Hunters.
Built by Bitcoiners, backed by the community. Block Hunters learn Bitcoin by playing.
We played at family night and everyone loved it. Finally, a game that gets Bitcoin.
Ready to orange pill the fun way? Head to blockhunters.com and use the code BTCMatrix for 10% off your order.
They can print anything they want.
Correct. And
therefore, they can come up with the 250,000. But if you put Bitcoin on deposit and they don't have the Bitcoin, they can't print it. So they can never actually fulfill a promise that's based in Bitcoin unless you could fully audit what's actually on deposit at the FDIC.
We can augment this any way we want, where we say, okay, you know, if whatever percentage you put half the Bitcoin, well, not even a whole Bitcoin at the bank, and the government even has to have a whole Bitcoin at proof of reserve. We could look at ways the government could insure Bitcoin, where we're insuring the third party. And the only thing I'm trying to circumvent here is the where Bitcoiners would be encouraged or feel safer depositing their Bitcoin at a bank, out of custody, and loan against it. And I think Bitcoiners are looking for a way to borrow against their Bitcoin at rates as fair as HELOCs and mortgages and all the other programs out there. And I was just riffing on that. I haven't worked out all the semantics, but
the only way you can do this where you actually back it is people can dig into this company called AnchorWatch. Okay. They're using a multi-key setup that they can prove that the other, you know, side of the Bitcoin and escrow is actually there because the one party can sign and the other party can sign. This is the only way you can do this. But at the end of the day, you actually have to have the full amount of Bitcoin there to insure it, period. There's no other way. And so you have a system, a fiat-based fractional reserve system that has used terminology and semantics to make people feel like they're getting a deal. But at the root of all of it is the money that they're putting on deposit actually is not there. And if it fails, they're just going to come up with they're going to clack on some keys and they're going to produce some more paper nothings and they're going to shove them down your throat at the expense of everybody having more monetary units in the system, whether they understand that or not. And so Bitcoin's very different. Bitcoin has to be treated very differently. And if it's not, well, you're going to learn the hard way. And that's
it. Yeah, for sure.
You're just going to learn the hard way.
Yeah, you make great points. What do you think about all the Bitcoin-backed treasury companies? We were just talking about the new Mahler's initiative. So, I mean, we haven't heard anything really definitive with GameStop. But MicroStrategy and now Strategy has really been kind of laying out the blueprint. Where do you see this going? Do you see sort of bigger adoption maybe coming from the inside? I mean, Cantor Fitzgerald is an inside player in SoftBank, but I mean, do you see like an Apple or Facebook or an Amazon or more sort of a traditional S&P 500 adoption?
I think you're going to see more traditional adoption, but I think it's going to be very different than what we've seen to date with MicroStrategy and some of these other ones that are just doing super bold. We're converting our entire marketable securities on our balance sheet to Bitcoin. Like, I don't think you're going to see that. I think what you're going to see is, you know, an Apple or a Google or whoever just take 5% of whatever they have as marketable securities, and they're going to turn that into Bitcoin. Similar to a perfect example is Tesla. Tesla put a little bit of Bitcoin on the balance sheet. They didn't go overboard. Percentage-wise, it was more like an insurance policy against the size of their marketable securities as a protection of printing and debasement of hyperinflation, really, was like the position size is how I would kind of categorize it. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that as opposed to these super bold over-the-top. I don't see it as over-top. I see it actually as totally responsible, and that's why I own stock in MicroStrategy. But I think that's how you're probably going to see it more likely roll out, especially for the big ones that have a lot of their equity distributed and the governance on it is like you know, spread out and they can't do anything bold or they're going to be fired. And so like all of those factors are the reason why you're going to see it roll out that way.
Yeah, for sure. Any maybe bold predictions for 2025?
I don't think I have much, man. I'm just...
Do you think it's going to be a calm year or a wild ride?
Well, so far it's been very wild. I know I'm just reporting the weather with that statement, but yeah, it's hard for me to tell just because there's been so much change in the way that the current administration is doing things. So I just don't really know how the tariff thing's going to shake out, especially if they can't get China to the table and do something here in the coming months. And then it's time for the next, you know, where everybody's tariffs are back on the table. Like, how does that shake out? It seems like Jerome Powell is like really dragging his feet as to like his appetite to start lowering rates. So that's a factor that, you know, it seemed like under the last administration, he seemed a little bit more accommodative, but maybe that's my own bias kind of coming out. So it's a little hard to kind of project, but I can tell you this, if things get really spicy, meaning like there's some really swift sell-offs in the market because some of this contagion sets in, the printing press will come on and it's going to come on like really, really strong. But I don't know if we're going to see that because so much of it comes down to like their ability to preemptive, you know, put liquidity into the system. And it seems like from what I'm seeing from an M2 standpoint, it seems like they're putting, you know, a decent amount of liquidity globally speaking, not US, but like globally, it seems like there's a lot of liquidity coming into the market. So it's, you know, some of that stuff offsets it and it's really hard to kind of make a projection. But I do know this, I'm not selling any Bitcoin. I'm just buying more. And the beauty in all of this is you don't have to be too, you don't have to think about it too much. You can just kind of do your craft, make your money, store it in Bitcoin and enjoy your life because you don't have to overthink this thing. They're going to print. They have to print.
Yeah, we'll see. I love what you're saying. My final question for you then, in terms of maybe enjoying your life, people's lives. What do you think of Ross getting out? I mean, he looks like he's enjoying his life finally, thank God.
Yeah, I'm very excited. He looks great, right? Like, he looks like he's just full life. He was blessed to have a wife that was there for him throughout all those trying times with, you know, the times, I'm sure, no hope that he was going to ever get out, which speaks just volumes of her and gave him hope. And, you know, I couldn't be happier for both of them that he is out. And it was really fun to see the community really rally around him, and just all of it was pretty joyous. So yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just a tremendous signal for our country and our world for freedom. What's favorite book you read lately?
Oh, dude, I've got a lot here. Hold on. Let's see. This book, it's titled On Intelligence, is really good. This one's really weird, but it was really good. It's called Mutant Message Down Under. It was wild.
How much reading do you get to do a week, or how many books do you maybe get in a week?
I used to do a book a week. Now I'm probably like one every other week, I would say, depending on, you know, if I'm listening to a lot of podcasts that I'm falling behind, but I try to get one like every other week, I'd say.
How much podcasts do you think you listen to a week?
I don't know. It comes in waves. Like I get an interest in AI, then I might be like deep down that or something, but I don't listen to any Bitcoin podcasts. I don't even really listen to many finance podcasts anymore, but yeah, no, I don't know. It depends on where my interest is at. It's all over the place.
Preston, this has been so dope, as always. I love chatting with you. Looking forward to seeing you in Vegas. I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you and your work.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. No, and thanks for having me. Preston Pish on Twitter and also on Noster. You can check out Primal. You know, say hi. I'll zap you some sats. And I have a podcast. It goes by the handle We Study Billionaires. It's I'm on every Wednesday with the Bitcoin content, and would love to have you there.
Awesome. Sounds great. Thanks for coming by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment below with any questions or thoughts you may have. We'd love to hear from you. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors and affiliate links in the description. It helps keep bringing you great content while connecting you with awesome products that I believe in. Share this episode with your friends, family, or anyone curious about Bitcoin. And let's keep growing this community together. Stay curious, keep stacking, and I'll catch you in the next one.